I do very much appreciate that which has gone before. I do ask that you be in prayer for us what time we stand before you. I was really hoping, as Brother Gary was praying, that due to some of the sentiments in his prayer, that the subject that I had on my mind would change. He talked about the preacher being having liberty and being loose to preach about the eternal redemption of God's people and the salvation that we have in Christ Jesus. And you've heard me say before that if I had my druthers, that would be all I preached about. I'd preach about that every time because it's just a glorious subject to consider. There are some subjects to consider that that are a bit more painful to us, and the one I have tonight on my mind is quite painful to me. It's been so long since we've preached here on Sunday night. I don't know if you remember, but in our series we have been going through on the identity of the church, the last thing we talked about was we finished up on the ordinances the church has. And moving forward into the structure of the church, the next item I'd like to consider are the offices within the church. And there are only two offices within the church that have been scripturally authorized. They are the office of a bishop or an elder and the office of a deacon. And whenever you consider the way the Lord designed His church, there's a lot of things in it that you might think, well, I wonder why the Lord did it that way. And when you consider that the Lord set His church up and designed it so that actual mortal, fallible men would be given the blessed privilege of expounding and declaring the most blessed things this world has ever seen, it's a humbling thing to me. It's a humbling thing that men have the privilege to declare what God had kept hidden and not revealed for thousands of years, but now has been made manifest in the person of Jesus Christ. As we talk about the first office of the church this evening, it's just a logical place to start, I believe, and to go to the third chapter of 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, Paul begins to describe some of the characteristics, some of the qualifications, and some of the marks that go along with the first office that we'd like to talk about. In 1 Timothy 3 and 1, Paul says, "This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work." When we consider this first office work, there is something about it that is different and apart, set apart, I should say, from the second office. One of them is God called. The other one is a church sought out. Whenever the deacons were first put into the church, the word given by the apostles was to search you out among you, seven men who are honest and full of the Holy Ghost. In other words, this was not a call that God had made, but rather the church had a need, and the church was to look out and find men suitable for that need. When it comes to the office of a bishop, when it comes to the office that I do try to, as best as I can, walk in, there is something particular about it that man just can't put in. There's something particular about it that man just cannot do. However, it is something that man does sense. It's something that man does see. It's something that if I didn't feel it, I would rather doubt that I had it. Because Paul, notice what Paul said, if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. The first thing that comes with this office work, Paul says, is there's a desire that goes along with it. There is a desire there to fulfill and to accomplish something. Now, one of the things that goes along with this desire is the Lord does not give a man a desire and leave him without the right tools to fulfill what he has the desire to do. When the Lord gives you a desire, you have the ability, you have the tools to perform it. Paul told Timothy a little later on in 1 Timothy 4 and 14, he says, "Neglect not the gift that was given unto thee by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery." Paul told Timothy, you have something in you that is a gift that God gave you. You say, well, what happens when the presbytery lays their hands on that man? They don't bestow a gift on him. They show that they're recognizing a gift that God has given that man. It says Timothy was given that gift by prophecy. Now, I know I've mentioned this here before, but it's worth mentioning again that when Timothy was given a gift by prophecy, that word prophecy has a very interesting definition. The word prophecy there means inspiration. Have you ever felt inspired to do something? Have you ever just felt inspired to do a certain thing? I was talking to a young brother who's here tonight who will remain nameless, but we were discussing about how when we were both courting, our prospective wives used to get more poetry than they do now. And it just seems to be a common occurrence that once you got her, all those little sweet things you did, they just don't happen as much anymore. Now, I'd do better if I could. No, I take that back. I could do better, and I should. But there is something about when you have your affection set upon a certain young lady, you feel inspired to do certain things. I mean, when it came down to the time when I was going to ask my wife to marry me, if she just said, stand on your head, and I'll say yes, I'd probably broke my neck, but I'd have tried to stand on my head. Because, friends, there was something about her that I wanted to be with her for the rest of my life. I felt inspired to that. And Timothy was told by Paul that you were given a gift by inspiration. God put it in. God breathed it into your very own person. Last Sunday morning, we talked about the parable of the talents. And one of the things about preaching is a man has to have a talent, he has to have a call, he has to have a gift that only God can put in for that. And the way that he knows that is that he has a desire that he wants to fulfill and accomplish what God has called him to do. He has a desire to do it. And this is a strong desire that he has. And you might say, does that mean that everybody that wants to be one is one? Well, there's different kinds of desires in this world. But notice this desire. This desire is a desire that has an understanding that goes with it. If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desires what? A good work. Means that his desire isn't that he would have some title, that he would have some place, some prominent place where everybody respected him and looked up to him. He has a desire because there is a work to be done and he wants to do it because he believes God has called him to do it. There is a desire there to work. Not a desire to be looked up to, but a desire to work and labor for God's people. And I'll say this. This is a desire that is stronger than any desire that I have ever known in this world. I'm not going to say it's stronger than any desire that the world has ever seen, because that place belongs solely to Christ. He had a desire for His people that was stronger than any other desire this world has ever experienced. But there is a desire with preaching that is very important. And it's a desire that if you ever try not to, and that desire is in there, it'll burn you up inside. You know, Jeremiah tried at one occasion to quit. He tried on one occasion to just say, this is it. I'm not going to do this anymore. In Jeremiah 20 and verse 9, Jeremiah says this, I said I'm not going to speak anymore in the name of the Lord. But His word was a fire shut up in my bones. He said that there was something inside that just burned me up inside. His word was a fire in my bones. And he said, I basically couldn't quit. He said his fire was in me. I was weary with forbearing and I could not stay. He said, I had to speak. You say, what happens to a preacher who has been called by God and who has been blessed by God, who finds himself in an immoral lifestyle? I have the utmost pity for the rest of his life. Because there's going to be a fire in his bones that he's not going to be able to get out because he is unqualified to the office that he's been called to, because he's unqualified himself, but that desire does not go away. It continues to burn him up inside. David had the same experience in Psalm 39. In Psalm 39, David says, I just decided I wasn't going to say anything. When I'm in front of the wicked, I'm just not going to say anything. And he said, I refrain my tongue from speaking, even from that which is good. He said, I decided, not only am I not going to say anything good, I'm just not going to say anything. And he said, and while I was musing, the fire burned hot within me. He said, when I just said I wasn't going to talk, he said, it burned me up inside because I knew I ought to say something. And if a man desires the office of a bishop, there is something that he feels that he needs to say. There is something that he feels that he needs to do. And there's a work that he feels that he has been called unto. So the first thing we need to be very clear about in this first office of the church is it's not something that anybody other than God can do. If it's not God called, it just ain't called. Is that plain enough? If it just ain't God called, it's just not called. So God calls the man, gives him the desire to do this. And the man has a work that he needs to do. Men desire the office of bishop. He desireth a good work. And this work that he has to do is a work in which he will find some of the greatest heartaches and some of the greatest blessings this world has ever seen. Because there's a high reward and there's a lot of sorrow that goes with it. There's a lot of highs and lows with this work. But before we move on, I'd just like to make this point in passing. The Bible does describe this office by two different names. And it's very important. In 1 Timothy 3 and 1, it's described as a bishop. If you go over to Titus 1 and 5, we find the word elder used. In Titus 1 and 5, Paul tells Titus to ordain elders in every city as I have appointed you. In other words, Titus' job was to ordain elders. You say, is there any difference between a bishop and an elder? Well, let's keep reading. He says that an elder must be the husband of one wife. He must be blameless, having his children in subjection, being sober. And then he says this in verse 7, Titus 1 and 7, he says, so then a bishop must be blameless. He just used those two terms together. He interchanged them. So a bishop and an elder, the same thing. You say, does that mean it's all right to call you Bishop Conley? Well, there's a funny story behind that. You could technically call me that, and it would technically be proper. There's a brother out in, he actually lives in Louisiana, but we knew him when we lived in Mississippi. And my father, natural father was preaching one day, and he made the comment that bishop and elder are exchangeable terms, that we can use one for the other. And he comes up to Dad after church and said, does this mean I can call you Bishop Conley? And of course, Dad said, not if you expect me to respond. Well, just out of a joke, it became a tradition every single year after that when he sent his Christmas card to our family. It was addressed to Bishop Conley and family. Well, the first year after I was ordained, I had a card in the mail that said to Bishop Conley and family. On the inside, it says, good luck carrying on this tradition. So you could technically call a minister a bishop. The reason we don't, the reason we primarily use the term elder is just to avoid any confusion over the terms, because other people have used the term bishop in a way it ought not be used. But it's very important to consider what those two terms mean. The word bishop, I believe, comes from a Greek word called episkopae. Now, the word episkopae means to actually fulfill and herald and teach and preach. That one of the functions that a minister has, one of the functions of this office that a bishop does, is he heralds, he teaches, he preaches, and he does things in a way in which he has the authority and the privilege to do so. I'm in a position right now where I have the authority and the privilege to be teaching you and instructing you in the things of God. That is part of what this office entails. But as an elder, elder comes from a Greek word that means presbyter. And a presbyter is one who actually fulfills and carries out ordinances of the church. It's not just one of my duties to preach and to teach and to herald. One of my duties is to faithfully ordain, fulfill the ordinances, to actually baptize people when they join, to administer the communion when it's time to have communion, for me to actually go about as an authorized agent of the church, doing as the will of the church would have me to do, in fulfilling the ordinances as God set them up. So those two words, those two titles, describe the office under consideration. Now, having said all of that, you're probably saying, well, preacher, can we all go home? We're not preachers. What does this have to do with us? Well, you hang with me. I may not get this done in 25 minutes like Brother Dan did last Sunday night, but you hang with me. Maybe we'll be done before an hour, and I hope to bring to bear why this is so important for all of us. It's so important for all of us for two reasons. One, you need to know what's required of a minister. And for the other reason, most of all, he is supposed to be something for you. So Paul says that a man who desires the office of bishop desires a good work. The work of heralding, the work of teaching, the work of ministering, and the work of actually fulfilling the ordinances and the duties of the church. Then he goes on and he starts describing some qualifications. Verse 2 is a list of qualifications that are positive. And verse 3 is a list of qualifications that are negative that he ought to be avoiding. And I'll just be honest with you. The reason this is so difficult for me is because every time I go through this passage of Scripture, I find myself failing in a lot of regards. I find myself needing to improve in a lot of areas. I don't know about you, but there's just certain areas of the Scripture when I know I'm approaching, I just cringe. I cringe because I know what it's going to say, and I know how I'm doing, and I know I don't measure up. How about you? Well, this is one of those passages for me. In verse 2, he says that a bishop must be blameless. Now, I don't want to attack all of these in great detail, but this one requires some discussion. A bishop must be blameless. This does not mean that if a man is going to fulfill this office that he has to be without sin. Because if it was, we'd only have one preacher who ever walked this earth, and that would be Jesus Christ, the righteous. But this word blameless means that he needs to be above reproach. That when you have a man occupying the office of a bishop or an elder in the church, he needs to be above reproach. That means that he does not have a cloud over him. He does not have legal things in the background that hang over him that cloud his ability to teach effectively because people wonder what kind of a person he is. I mean, if you thought when I came to church that I was some kind of a person who was just looking to steal your wife, how just safe would you feel in church? You'd be worried about how your wife was in my presence. Or if you were worried about me because I had a history of being a pickpocket, you might be walking around me holding your back pocket saying, well, I don't want them to get mine. A bishop has to be blameless. He has to be above reproach. That there has to be a reputation there that does not follow him around. And to be above reproach requires a life of virtue, a life of moral uprightness. And sometimes if you've had some rough beginnings, it requires a little time to outgrow. For example, how long do you think it took before Paul outgrew his reputation as Saul of Tarsus? Long time. And I imagine with some people, he never outgrew it. That's why the Lord in His infinite wisdom sent Paul to preach to some people who didn't know him as Saul of Tarsus. He sent him to some Gentiles who didn't know his past. Because if you were one of Stephen's relatives, who Paul actually held the coats of the people who stoned Stephen to death, how would you like Paul to actually come preach to you? I mean, if I had killed one of your relatives, how willing would you be to sit here right now and listen to me preach? I'm going to be honest. If you killed one of my people, if you killed my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, I wouldn't want to listen to you preach. I'm just going to be honest. As a man, there would be a reproach there. There would be something there that would be hard for me to get past. But a minister, a bishop, must be above reproach. He must be blameless. The next qualification is he must be the husband of one wife. Now, this particular qualification gets debated foolishly in some circles. There are some people who use this qualification to try to prove that a man has to be married before he gets into the ministry. Well, if that was the case, Paul wouldn't have made it. Because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 that he would that all men were as he were. And what was that? Single. Because being single, he didn't have a wife to care for. He didn't have divided time and divided attention. He said, if all men could be like me, he said, you could just concentrate on serving the Lord. And I'm a man of the world. I understand that a family takes time. It takes effort. But dear friends, I'm thankful for the family I have, but I understand that if a man can be single, it might be better for him as a minister. And the reason it can be is because he doesn't have a family to worry about taking care of. So Paul wasn't even married. So this qualification is not saying a man has to be married. It's saying if he is married, here's how he has to be married. He has to be the husband of one wife. He has to be a man who is not only morally upright, who is above reproach, but who is also a monogamous person. He has one wife. And no matter how you twist that language, it will not say the wife of one husband. It says the husband of one wife. That means that a man, and only a man, can fulfill the office of a bishop or an elder. I don't care how perverted society becomes, a man and only a man is called by God to fulfill this office. Because only a man can be the husband of one wife. You back up a few verses later, or a few verses earlier, at the end of chapter 2 of 1 Timothy, Paul says, I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man. Paul says it's not a woman's place to come to church and to teach. Is this because women can't teach? My wife's a wonderful teacher, but it's not her place. I don't mean that to be offensive. That's just the way God put it down in His book. And I'll just tell you this little funny story. I don't know if I've told this before. There was a minister out in California who had a problem at one time. He had a couple in his church, and the man thought he was called to preach, and he wasn't. But to top it all off, his wife thought she was called to preach. Well, she definitely wasn't. Well, he had three daughters, and this couple had three sons, and they were all about the same age. And one Fifth Sunday meeting, this woman who's trying to convince this minister of her call to preach and how he really shouldn't cringe from it, that it was really okay, God had called her and she knew it would be all right. Well, as she's trying to make her case, he's watching her three boys run around the churchyard terrorizing his three daughters. And he finally had enough of her, and he just cut her off and said, Sister, you know what? You are called to preach. There's your congregation. Go preach to them. We all have different roles and responsibilities in this world, and just because a woman doesn't have a place to teach in church doesn't mean she doesn't have a gift to teach. Paul tells Titus that one of the things he's to encourage the women in the church in is for the older sisters to teach the younger sisters, that they have a place to show them by example and to teach them by word and deed, not in a public setting like this, but to help them, show them what it means to be a faithful wife in this world. That is a place for a woman to have. But as far as the office of a bishop goes, it can only be a man that does so. It has to be the husband of one wife. And then Paul goes on. Not only does he have to be the husband of one wife, he has to be a man who is sober, a man who is vigilant, a man who is of good behavior, A man who is given to hospitality and one who is apt to teach. Now, being sober and vigilant means there is no room to just say, well, I'm going to take the day off today. Being sober and vigilant means you always have your lights burning. You always have your mind and your heart in the right place. One of the things that just tickles me when I go out and work in a secular field is people call you a part-time preacher. They ever call you all a part-time preacher? And the reason they call you a part-time preacher is because, well, you've got a job, so you have to be a part-time preacher. Well, there is no such thing as a part-time preacher. A part-time preacher ain't no preacher. Either you're a preacher or you're not. And friends, when it comes to being sober and vigilant, this is one of the things that I find myself very lacking in, because there's times when I know that I just check out for a little while. My mind just leaves me and I just do the things that I want to do. To be sober and to be vigilant means, as God described Ezekiel in Ezekiel 33, that a minister is like, or a man of God is like a watchman upon the tower of the city. Now, if your job is to watch the tower of the city, what room is there for doing what you want to do? What room is there for sleeping on the job? There is none, because if the enemy comes while you're asleep or while you're distracted, people like you could be eaten up and devoured, and whose fault would it be? It'd be mine, because God set me as a watchman over the city. So to be sober, to be vigilant, of good behavior. Notice this one, given to hospitality. You know what that phrase, given to hospitality, means? Look it up sometime. The phrase given to hospitality literally means fond of guests. Now, I'm thankful that over the course of my years, I've been blessed to come into many homes, many good homes among the old Baptists. But if you want to find out how good or how faithfully I follow this example, you got to come see me. And I'll give you an open standing invitation. If you want to come see me, come see me. Because one of my requirements is I have to be given to hospitality. I have to be fond of guests. And one of the reasons that's so important is because it's important that people see the preacher when he's not right here. We're going to get to that in just a minute. But you know, there's a lot of men who can act a certain way and be a certain way for a little while and hide who they really are. If you come see me at my home, I promise you're going to see the real me. I say that with a little bit of cringing, but you're going to see the real me. You'll see me kick back in my recliner and probably in some clothes that don't look like these. You're going to see a man who doesn't look like a preacher, because we don't always look like preachers. Sometimes we just look comfortable. So a man must be given to hospitality. He must be fond of guests. And notice this one, apt to teach. One of the requirements that a man as a minister has to have is he has to be apt or able to teach. You've heard me say many times before that if at the end of the day you don't understand a single thing that I've said, I have failed as a minister on that occasion. A minister's qualification means that you are able to understand what he lays out there. If you don't, I have failed. One of the stories that just tickles me about this is some people get the idea that preaching's just not supposed to be all that easy to understand. Folks, preaching ought to be the easiest thing to understand. And the reason it ought to be the easiest thing to understand is because this is the greatest subject, the greatest thing that we could ever talk about in this world. Why make it complicated? Why not preach it and teach it in the simplest way possible? Now, I'll admit there's some things in the Bible that are hard for me to understand, but when I preach, it ought to be in words easy to be understood. Paul, one of the greatest learned men who'd ever walked this earth, said in 2 Corinthians 3 and 12, I believe, he said, seeing we have this hope, he's been describing the hope that we have in Christ Jesus, that he's so much better than anything else that this world has ever seen. Seeing then that we have this hope, Paul says, we use great plainness of speech. How wild are you if a preacher gets up here and he uses words that are this long? I'm impressed, but if at the end of the day I don't know what that means, it doesn't do me any good. And I'll say this, while not all teaching is preaching, if the sermon doesn't have teaching in it, it's just not preaching. Fair enough? I've heard some people say, well, he's a good preacher, but he's not a good teacher. I'll just be honest, reading the Bible, I don't see how that's possible. Because if a man is going to be a good preacher, there is teaching involved in it. Now, granted, preaching is a lot more than just teaching you. It's a lot more than just instructing your mind, because preaching does what no other form of instruction does in this world. It feeds your soul like nothing else can. It actually cheers and warms your heart, unlike a lecture will do. I've seen men that were good at lecturing, but they wouldn't have made very good preachers, because at the end of the day, I was beaten down by their lecture. Friends, preaching has to warm your heart and feed your soul, but on top of that, you have to be instructed by it. And if I'm not apt or able to teach,
I have failed in my duties and my business as a minister of the gospel in the office of a bishop or an elder. Then moving on into verse 3, here are some things that a bishop has to avoid. He's not supposed to be given to wine. Now, you can slice and dice that any way you want to. It just means he's not supposed to be a drunkard. Doesn't say a minister's not supposed to drink, he's just not supposed to be a drunkard. Being given to wine is a man who is fond of it too much. Go back up to that last verse. Given to hospitality. Given to hospitality means I'm fond of guests. It means that I should be ready and willing to welcome you into my home whenever you need to be there. Given to wine means that I am ready and willing to welcome wine into my life whenever and whatever time there is. That's being a drunkard. And a minister who's supposed to be sober and vigilant ought not be a drunkard. Not given to wine. And then he goes on that not only is he not supposed to be given to wine, he is not supposed to be one who is greedy of filthy lucre. One who's not up here covetous for money. One who doesn't preach for the dollar. Now, I'll tell you this. Paul, we're going to talk probably in a few weeks about the order of the church and the obligation that we have in a financial way. But you know, Paul said something in 1 Corinthians 9, I believe, in about verse 16. As he's talking about the finances of the church, I had an interesting conversation this past week with a fellow employee, and he was just shocked beyond all belief when I told him that I didn't preach tithing. He said, "You don't preach tithing twice a year?" I said, "No, I sure don't." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I don't believe in it." He said, "You don't believe in it?" I said, "No, I don't. If I don't believe in something, I ought not preach it." He said, "Well, do you teach that people have a responsibility to give?" "Well, certainly I do." He said, "Well, what do you teach?" I said, "I teach the New Testament principle of giving out of a cheerful heart." And he said, "Well, that just gives somebody a reason to give less than 10%. I said, "If their heart's not cheerful, I guess it does." You know, if you have a cheerful heart, 10% just sometimes seems like not enough. When you have a cheerful heart, you always desire to do more than you want to do. And Paul said as a minister with a cheerful heart in 1 Corinthians 9 and 16, he said, "I preach not to get something out of you. If I preach and I didn't get anything from you," he said, "if I didn't preach because of that, woe is me if I don't preach the gospel. If I say, well, they're not giving me anything, so I'm just going to quit," he said, "woe is me." Why? Because there is a desire there that regardless of what you get or don't get, regardless of how you feel or don't feel, Paul said, "woe is me if I preach not the gospel. I'm not doing it for filthy lucre. I'm not doing it for money. And any man who does is not a minister of the gospel. He should not be greedy of filthy lucre. He should not be a striker. He should not be one who gets in fights all the time. He should not be a striker. He should not be greedy of filthy lucre. He should be patient, not covetous, not a brawler. He is one whose life is measured by gentleness and peace, not by getting something out of people or beating up people. That's not a minister of the gospel." Now, for the sake of not going through all those things in large detail, I think you pretty much get an idea of how I'm not supposed to be or how a bishop or an elder is not supposed to be. We're not to be beating up each other. We're not supposed to be trying to get money out of each other. We're not to be covetous, or the phrase "not a brawler" means that you're just unpeaceable. We shouldn't be unpeaceable. We should be easy to get along with. But I want to go to the next verse, because the next verse is very important, and it gets more so with me as life goes on. It says, "One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity." And then Paul, sort of as an aside, just puts in a little comment in parentheses and says, "For if a man know not how to care for his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" One of the things that you can always measure a minister by is if you see one of these things, it's like seeing the other. If you've only seen a man who is a minister with his children, or if you've only seen a man who is a minister in this capacity, preaching or teaching or pastoring, what you see here will mirror what happens in his home. What happens in his home will mirror what happens here. If you have a man who is harsh with his children, if you have a man who is just unfair with his children, you're going to find a man who here is harsh with the flock. A man who is unfair here with the flock. If you find a man in his home who is undisciplined, one whose children just run all over the place and do whatever they want, and dad doesn't do anything except sit there in his recliner and click through channels on the TV and say, well, I'm going to go out of this room, it's too noisy. You're going to find a man who in the church of God is very lazy and undisciplined and just doesn't care about the well-being and the welfare of the flock. But on the other hand, if you find a man who with his children is very devoted, who is very loving, who corrects them when necessary, and tries to exercise the fairness and the right, just things in his house, you'll find a man who likewise will take those same principles into the church of God and apply them there the same way. Because what is the thing that it says? He's one who has his children in subjection with all what? With all gravity. You know what that word gravity means? It means honesty. Or venerableness. Venerableness is not a word that is often heard anymore. You ever heard somebody called venerable? It was heard a lot 50 and 100 years ago, but you don't hear many people say it now. I'll leave that alone. You have people who are called venerable. And what are they normally? They're judges. They're justices. They're people who are supposed to give decisions from their bar and from their court. And why are they called venerable? Because they're honest. They're above reproach. They have to be, because if they're going to be giving these types of decisions, they have to be living good, upright lives themselves. But what is honesty, really and truly? What is honesty? Notice the term that is used there. The term that is used there is the term gravity. This was a long time before that apple hit Isaac Newton on top of his head. It was a long time before people actually drew out long equations and showed you what the gravitational force was upon this earth. But why do you think it is that they called that force gravity? They called that force gravity because no matter where you go, the force is the same. No matter where you go, the force is the same. You've seen the example that if you hold two objects that are of unequal weight and you let them drop at the same time, which one's going to hit the ground first? They're going to hit the ground at the same time. Doesn't matter which one weighs more, they're going to hit the ground at the same time because gravity has the same force upon objects on this earth. What is having your children in subjection with all gravity? What is taking care of the house of God with all gravity? It's having equal force and fairness in all things. That means that a minister of the gospel has to not be double-tongued, he can't be two-faced, he has to be honest in all things so that every time you see him, every decision he makes, he's going to make the same type of decision the same right way every time. That means I can't be this way today and another way tomorrow. When you see me now, I ought to be exhibiting the things that you can expect to see tomorrow. Because what does James say in James 1 and 11, I believe? He says that a man who is double-tongued, who is double-minded, is unstable as water. If you find somebody who changes their mind all the time, who doesn't really know what's right, who's not really honest, who's kind of deceptive in the way they do things, they are unstable as water. That means when I raise my children, it ought to be the same thing every time. Consistency, in other words. My children should know tomorrow what is expected of them, because it's the same thing that's expected of them today. And they should know what's expected of them the next day, because it's the same thing that's expected of them today. You say, boy, the preacher is tough tonight. Remember who we're talking about. We're talking about preachers. If you think this is hard, imagine how this feels to me. Because friends, if I fail with my children to bring them up in the right way, what does Paul say? If a man know not how to care for his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Just put this in perspective. Doesn't matter how large or small the church is. If I can't take care of two or three or four or five children, or even if I was to get those dozen that I wanted, that I'm not going to get, but even if I was going to get those dozen children, I rather suspect that in a church setting, I'm going to be ministering to more than 12 people. Well, if I can't handle 12, what gives me any indication that I can handle 50 or 100 or however big the church is? If a man can't take care of small things, he can't take care of big things. Going back to the parable of the talents, what does the master say when he comes to reckon with his servants? When those servants come and say, Lord, I've gained 5 talents from the 5 talents you've given me. Or I've gained 2 talents from the 2 talents you've given me. He always says, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over what? Over a few things. I'll make thee ruler over many things. Friends, if we hope to expect to do great things in the service of God, that means we've got to be very diligent in the small things. The very little things, because those are important, because the more of them you let slide, you're developing a lifestyle that when something big happens, you can't deal with it. If I can't deal with my own children, what reason do I have to think that I could deal and keep a good house and be a good overseer in the house of God? I have no reason to believe so. That means if you see a man who is failing with his children, expect to see a man who will one day fail as a minister. If you see a man who is doing very well and the Lord is blessing him with his children, expect to see a man who will one day be a very good minister, if he's not already. Because how a man's life with his family is will mirror his life as a minister. Paul says it right there. It's as clear as it can be that how you are with one is how you'll be with the other. Then moving on, I told you I promised to try to get you out of here before an hour, and I'm going to try to make good on my promise. The next thing Paul mentions is that he's not a novice. And the reason he can't be a novice is because if he is, he might be lifted up and fall into condemnation of the devil. Being a novice is basically just being ignorant. It's one who's too naive, too unlearned, too ignorant to know how he ought to be. Now, sometimes in today's world, people think ignorant means stupid. It doesn't. Ignorant means unlearned. It means just unknowledgeable. One of the reasons why churches wait a while before a man is ordained is because this is a qualification. He can't be a novice. Because if he's a novice, what's going to happen to him? When he realizes what he doesn't know, he's going to do one of two things. He's going to crumple and die, or two, he's going to say, well, you're wrong, I really do know this. Each one of those is bad because he's falling into condemnation of the devil. Solomon says about talking about novices. He says in Proverbs 26 and 5, he says, if you're dealing with a novice, if you're dealing with somebody who's ignorant, he says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he being lifted up in his own pride, lest he be lifted up in his own conceit or his own pride. There are some people, when they're ignorant, they need to be talked to, because if they're not, they're going to think they've got all the answers. They're going to think they've all got it figured out. Now, folks, any minister who ever thinks he's got it all figured out truly is a novice. No man has it all figured out. No man has all the answers. And if you see a way in which I'm ignorant, instruct me, because I need to not be ignorant in certain things. But if I'm ignorant, if I'm a novice, I will fall into condemnation of the devil. The devil will use that to make me fall, and my reputation will suffer as a result of it. And then the last thing that Paul mentions there is he says, having a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into a snare and reproach of the devil. It's not enough that you all think well of me. It's not enough that you all think well of any minister or any bishop or any elder that you have among you. It's not enough that he have a good report of us here in the house of God. He must also live a life that people in the community say, that's a good person. I might not agree with what he preaches, but that's a good person. He lives an exemplary life. He lives a life that is above reproach, and they have a good report among us. Dear friends, if you talk to people that know me out in the community, you ought to get a good report of my life and my behavior. If you don't, then I'm failing as a minister of the gospel. We have to have a good report of them that are without. Now, having gone through all that, you say, what's the point? I'm not a minister. Well, the first thing is, you need to know how to measure a minister that you have among you. If he doesn't measure up to these things, if he's failing in these things, he either needs some instruction, he needs to be set down for a while. But notice what a minister is. Go with me to 1 Peter chapter 5. A minister is something who is someone who is very important. In 1 Peter 5 and 1, Peter makes this statement. He says that he exhorts the elders which are among you. He's exhorting elders. He's exhorting the very people occupying this office. And then what does Peter say about himself? He said, who am also an elder. He said, well, I thought Peter was an apostle. He was. But when it came to the qualifications of an elder or a bishop, Peter says, they apply to me too. He said, I'm also an elder, just like you are. And then you go on down, as Peter begins his exhortation to the elders. He talks about how an elder shouldn't be greedy of filthy lucre. That sound familiar? We talked about that earlier. He talks about how an elder should take the oversight of the congregation. That means that he ought to be willing to lead in this, as an overseer in the paths of righteousness. And then he says, not by constraint, but willingly. He shouldn't be forced to do it. He should be willing to do this. That's his desire. And then he goes on and he says this. He should not have this by constraint, but willingly. And then he says, to be an ensample to the flock. What is one of the most powerful sermons a minister can preach? It ain't up here. The most powerful example, or the most powerful sermon a minister can preach is when I get out of this pulpit and I start walking around. Because that's when you're going to see whether I am someone who is blameless, That's when you're going to see if I'm someone who has ruled his own house well, having his children in subjection with all gravity. That's when you're going to see if I'm not given to wine, if I'm not a striker, if I'm not a brawler. That's when you're going to see those things. You're going to see those things with my feet. You're not going to see those things with my tongue. You're going to see how I walk and how I act here in this world. And how I act ought to be a good example how all of us should act. You've heard me mention many times that a minister is not held to any different moral standard or moral code than anybody else. Next weekend, if the Lord blesses, you're going to see the same thing with a deacon. A deacon is not held to a different moral code or a moral standard. But friends, as an officer of the church, you ought to be able to say about your pastor, he is a good example of how to live your life. He is a good example of how I ought to be, because he's living a life of virtue and he's trying to set the best example he can for the congregation. If I'm not doing that, regardless of how you feel about my preaching, if I don't do that, if you don't have a good example in your pastor, if you don't have a good example in the men that minister unto you, you don't have a good preacher. I don't know how to say it any other way than that. You don't have a good preacher if I don't live a good exemplary life. There ought to be an ensample to the flock. I ought to be one so that when you look at me, you don't have to hang your head and say, "That's our pastor." You mean the guy who was in jail last weekend? Yeah, that's him. You mean the guy who was, was formerly a pickpocket who spent some time in prison because he did this and because, yeah, that's our pastor. It ought to be one where you say, our pastor shows a good example of how to live our life. I'll go to one final place and I promise I'll quit. Later in the epistle of 1 Timothy, chapter 4, right before Paul gets into the discussion about Timothy's gift, when he tells him not to neglect the gift that is in him, Paul says in 1 Timothy 4 and 12, and a lot of people just quote the first half of this verse, but you really need to quote all of it. 1 Timothy 4 and 12, Paul says, "Let no man despise thy youth." I don't know how old Timothy was. I really don't. Obviously, he was young. I don't know if he was as young as I am. I'm 30 years old, and people tell me that's young. I imagine when I get to be some of your age, I'll think 30 is young. Right now, I don't think it's all that young, because I got people who are younger than me calling me old and decrepit. I got people calling me sir. That's strange to hear. I don't know how you feel when I was told earlier tonight not to call somebody ma'am. Well, that's just the way I was raised. She said, "I might be twice your age, but don't call me ma'am." Well, I can't help it. That's just the way I was raised. But I tell you, it's a strange thing to be 30 years old and hear people say yes sir and no sir, other than my two children. They need to. But if yours tell me yes or no sir, that's strange to me, because I don't feel that old. But Timothy was obviously a young minister. He said, "Let no man despise thy youth." The Lord has called certain men to this work, certain men to this office who are very young. Now, there ought to be a sense in which they're not boyish. There ought to be a sense in which they're not just brats. You know, you've heard of some preachers that when they got started, they were brats. In my opinion, they may have got started too young. No amens, but they may have got started too young. But if a man is young in years, that doesn't necessarily mean that he is young in mind. Does not necessarily mean he is young in the way he thinks about things. Because friends, sometimes there have been people I know that were young that thought very wise. And there's been some 60, 70, 80, even some 100-year-olds who did not have Alzheimer's, by the way, who were some of the most childish thinkers I've ever seen. It's not always an idea of just how old you are in years. And Timothy was obviously one who had a lot of wisdom and had a lot of thoughtful things about how he ought to be, because Paul said, "Don't let anybody despise thy youth." In other words, you're going to be instructing people who are older than you are. I don't know how you felt, but whenever I first started, it was a hard thing for me to understand that I was talking to people and instructing people who are older than I am. That's hard sometimes when I consider it. But Paul says, "Let no man despise thy youth." But here's the rest of that verse. "But be thou an example unto the believers." In other words, if you want people to really appreciate your instruction, if you want people to really listen to what you're having to say, you be an example unto the believers. In what ways? A lot of ways. In faith, in charity, in spirit. In all these different ways, be an example unto the believers. Brother Gary prayed in his prayer that the Lord would give me liberty of mind to say certain things. But did you notice how else he prayed? Not just to say the right things, but to say them in the right way. Be an example, not just in faith, but also in charity, in spirit, in the way you do it. You ought to see in a minister an example,
not just of what is the truth, but the right way to approach it. And the best way to observe that is to observe a man's life. Like I said, this is a very hard thing sometimes for me to consider. Because as I view this list of qualifications, I see so many things that not only do I need to improve in, I need to improve a lot in. Because friends, none of us has ever got to a point where we can say, I've arrived. But for your sake, I need to do better. If not for my own sake, I need to do better for your sake. Because I need to be an example. I need to be a good one. And if I'm not even going to do it for me, I need to be willing to do it for you. So that when you say, we have a good example in our pastor, I'll know that I'm doing things that are of benefit to you. Lord willing, next Sunday night, we might talk about the office work of a deacon. But if these things have been offensive, I do pray that the Lord will forgive me, and you will too, because I certainly didn't mean anything to be offensive. But if these things have been a blessing, if you have learned, if you have been instructed, if your soul has been fed, you praise and give glory to God, because I'm a man who needs His help every single day. May the Lord richly bless you, is my prayer.